All right, we ready. Hey, y'all, before we go into the interview with Fatima Oskar, we tell you all the time, like, the folks who we're bringing in are really doing groundbreaking work and having an impact both in Chicago and in the world beyond. And so recently, we just want to acknowledge, Fatih and the homie Sam Bailey had a big honor bestowed upon them.
They were on Forbes' 30 Under 30 list, which is their annual encyclopedia of creative disruption featuring 600 young stars in 20 different industries. It's pretty dope that, you know, we got one in Chicago.
No, very raw. I also feel like if they're on the Forbes list, I feel like they're rich, so I'm going to fight you up for a loan, so we'll see what it is. But
we're rich by proxy.
We are starting.
So official. Should we introduce ourselves?
We should. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, we should introduce the whole thing. So this is called The Corner Store. This is the inaugural podcast.
Yes.
That Tara Mahadevan and I, Kevin Koval, are beginning. Do you want to introduce yourself, Tara?
Yeah. I just want to say that there's a point where you didn't know how to say my last name.
I know, but I did. I started. You know what I had to do, and this is my trick with everything. I had to rhyme it with something else.
What? Wait, what?
Yeah, Tara Mahadevan, Nightmares Like Wes Craven.
That's amazing.
That was my. You didn't know that. That's what I have to do with any name that I need to remember. I need to come up with a compounded rhyme for, because
what was mine?
I think I just knew your name, but because you gave me, and by the way, our first ever guest. Well, whatever. This might not even be the first one. Who knows? But I just want to introduce properly Fatima Oskar. And I think, you know, Fatih, you gave me like Oscar the Grouch joint. What do you say about how do you teach someone your name?
Is that it's like Oscar the Grouch, yeah.
Right. So that was, you already gave me that is it a mnemonic device?
Yeah, or like way to remember. Yeah, I don't know what that means. Sure.
I don't know. All right, but wait, I wanna be formal before
true intros.
I wanna introduce you formally. This is the bio off your website, and I'm gonna say maybe a bunch of other nice shit about you. But here we go. No, just here. Okay. You don't have to listen, but this is what it is, y'all, just so you know who you're rocking with. Fatima Oskar is a nationally touring poet, screenwriter, educator, and performer. Her works appeared in many journals, including Poetry Magazine, Gulf Coast BuzzFeed, Reader, The Margins, The Offing, Academy of American Poets, and many others. Her work's been featured on news outlets like PBS, NPR, Time, Teen Vogue, Huffington Post, and others. In 2012, she created a spoken word poetry group in Bosnia-Herzegovina called Reflex while on a Fulbright studying theater in post-genocidal countries. Damn. She is a member of the Dark Noise Collective and a Kuniman Fellow. Her chapbook After came out on Yes Yes Books in fall of 2015. She is also the writer and co-creator of Brown Girls, an Emmy-nominated web series that highlights friendships between women of color. Her debut book of poems, Today We're American, is forthcoming on One World Random House Press. That's who Fatima Oskar is.
Lit. I didn't know the last part.
Oh, about the book?
Yeah, congrats.
Thanks. Thank you.
Yeah, it's so many things, and we're gonna.
So many.
Yeah, I mean, you are a hyphenate, because you do a billion things. But before we get into those things, we have a gift for you.
Oh, are we going to start with it?
Yeah, yeah, right. True. Well, because then you could, like, snack while you also.
But you don't want to be snacking, like, in the mic. You got to press the cough button. Feel me?
Or just chew properly. Do you know what I mean? I don't know. We'll see.
I don't know how people eat their snacks.
We're going to get very familiar, evidently. But this is called The Corner Store for a lot of reasons. And so, Fatih, Tara went to the. Do you want to talk about the corner store you went to in order to pick up these delights?
Yes. I went to the one next to Young Chicago Authors on Milwaukee. Like Milwaukee and Haddon, and I hear that they have the best honey buns, so that's why, it's probably something.
Oh, that's one.
Yes.
Okay.
Why don't you? Yeah.
All right. So Fatih, so part of what we wanted, we got you got.
Well, one is in there particularly.
Four.
Yes.
Okay. I'm gonna peruse. Is this one? Oh, this.
No, the long one.
Yes. Oh, I see. Okay. All right. So, but should I go these three initially?
I don't know. I picked.
Here, all right, I'm
I picked
go these
three sweet, two savory, and one drink. So,
All right, cool. I'm gonna go these three for right now.
Okay, that's cool.
All right. So, Tara, what we want to do is we want to pick out different delicacies from the corner
store. Curate the wrap or the snack portion.
Look, snack game. Yeah. lot of, you know, and you choose which one you want.
Great.
All right. So this evening from the Milwaukee and Haddon Corner Store, there is a, of course, a classic Little Debbie Honey Bun. All right, so that's choice number one.
Nice.
Also, some wrap snacks,
yes.
Little Boozy wrap snacks, the Louisiana Heat version, of course.
Yes, nice.
You know, shout out to Boozy.
Nice.
And then, you know, we had like an insight into maybe potentially what you had a penchant for. These are some Uncle Al's coconut macaroon cookies.
Ooh, yeah.
So you know, so. Look, the choice is yours. I mean, we're also going to partake. But, you know.
So when I pick something, that means all of us are going to eat that thing.
Nah, I think that's your. All right.
I don't know.
Damn. I guess we've never played this game
yeah,
before.
I mean, like, yeah. This is new.
I guess
everyone.
We could also share.
Yeah, we could share.
Because then that would change snacks. My answer.
I mean, I think in my mind, it was like you choose your snack and you just ride with that snack.
Yeah.
It's like,
I mean, you could have all of it or you could share.
Or you could share, right. I guess
but
that's your choice.
Okay, I want to pick something that we then all eat.
Well, no. We're going to eat
any
all
of them.
Them.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Right.
I bought all stuff I would eat, and I figured everyone would.
Okay.
As long as you eat.
You know, meat. I'll do the Little Boozy chips.
Okay. Oh,
okay. All right. Okay. Yeah, Little Boozy.
Yeah,
little
be adventurous.
Boozy. I'm gonna... All right, here you go. I'm gonna throw it. Okay.
Have right. you ever had wrap snacks? I have not.
No, I haven't. So I'm
They
excited.
Only had Fetty Wap, and then they had Romeo, Little Romeo, or... I don't remember.
It's like a regional thing. Okay, that's a loud.
I don't know.
Is it really loud?
No, that's good though.
That's a good sound effect.
Should
right?
I press the cough button next time?
No, you're good. Tara, do you care for a honey bun or a coconut macaron?
No, I'm okay.
Okay.
Right now.
All right.
Really loud.
Yeah, look, brought to you by the unofficial sponsor, Wrap Snacks.
Wrap Snacks. I feel like we should come up with a tagline.
I know. cool. So but Fatih, you know what? I do want to ask you though. Is did you have a favorite snack as a kid, and what was it? What was like either like a comfort food or some sort of snack that you liked as a little
yeah.
one?
Yeah, you know, I went through so many different phases of snacks. I remember being I don't remember exactly what grade it was. Maybe it was sixth grade, but we used to. So there was the way I grew up in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and there was different neighborhoods that people would just say were like. Actually, it was just one neighborhood that we knew all the white kids grew up in, and they had access to the best corner store snacks because they would, like, get the fancy snacks. And we, this girl, Maggie Dunphy, had a hustle where we would all pay Maggie to get us Jawbreaker candies because her corner store was the only one that had them because none of us had access to them. So she would, like, literally come every day and overcharge us for the Jawbreaker candies, and we would pay her money, and then she would bring the Jawbreaker candies to school. So that was like a thing I distinctly remember was paying my friends who lived in West Cambridge for like, you know, more high-end like snacks.
Damn.
Yeah.
She was running game. She was
really
like
funny.
A hustle.
And she like surcharged you or whatever, yeah. Like a finder's fee type.
Yeah. Do y'all also remember?
Taxing.
They had those, they had like, I don't remember what they were called, but they came in a tube and it was this gel that was like kind of sour and you would squeeze it out of that, of this tube. I don't, but that
maybe
they
that was just
also
like
only
toothpaste. I don't know. Maybe had.
They also only had those in West Cambridge, and we would pay our friends to get them for us, and they would. Yeah, that was like the.
Are
thing.
Are they your friends though?
For real,
I
right?
Mean, yeah. Anybody, if you had monopoly on the best corner store snacks, wouldn't you upcharge your everybody's to get like?
No, because.
Yes, you would.
I
no.
would. I did.
Know if
I did. No, can I tell you? I had the Ring Pop scam out the locker. I was like mm-hmm. slang. I was like hustling Ring Pops as a kid at Grove Elementary. You know what I mean? Yeah. No.
I hustled edibles in high school.
Listen,
I think that's the only thing.
Takes all kinds.
Yeah.
So Fatih, you grew up in Cambridge,
mm-hmm.
In Cambridge, Mass.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like being you in Cambridge, Massachusetts?
You know, I love Cambridge a lot. And I think I get really sensitive about this because people like talk a lot of shit about Boston. And a lot of people's critiques about Boston is that it's a white city, right? Is that like it's a white area. And that just isn't true. I think Boston and Cambridge gentrified really early. And was among a wave of gentrification that happened with the tech boom, but it was pretty early because of MIT's presence there and all the university's presences. But growing up, like, you know, I grew up in a really, really diverse area that had a lot of people that were from first-generation immigrant families from all over. So we had folks who were from, you know, South Central and Latin America. We had folks from who were immigrants from Africa, folks who were immigrants from all over Asia, folks who were immigrants from Europe. And it was this really kind of amazing thing where you had all of these different cultures all living right next to each other, often in like apartment buildings and going to the same schools. And so a lot of my friends came from really different areas, and it really, really influenced my kind of sense of being and also my sense of folks who helped raise me and what culture was and the permeability of culture. And there is a way that, you know, when I go back, that home no longer exists, like because of gentrification, because of forces like that. A lot of folks left and were and, you know, no longer live there. And it is a very, very different place than it was. But so there's kind of a home that I have that is like the home of my memory that is no longer there. But it's really sad because that was like that was in a really magical place to be growing up. And there was, all, of course, things that were wrong. We were all racist to each other. There was problems. There was, you know, there was not fun things about it. But it gave me really the sense of who I am and the sense of being like a person that is just really interested in a lot of different things around culture and around language and around permeability as well.
Mm-hmm. Was that like a rarity, your neighborhood having that many being that diverse?
I didn't think so. I mean, I thought that was like the normal, you know, I thought that was what America was. And then it wasn't really until I got into college and, you know, my friends from college would come home with me because it was like an hour on the train. And that was when I realized that my upbringing was not like other people's upbringing, right? That was when I realized that, like, because Cambridge was also, it was really racially diverse, but it was also really socioeconomically diverse. So you had a high school in which you had folks who were like the kids of Harvard professors who had a lot of money. And then you also had folks who were, you know, Section 8, and we all were in the same, we were all like together. And so there was a way that I think it, when I went to college, I realized that was not most people's backgrounds, especially in high school. I think a lot of folks kind of found other layers of diversity upon going into college, but that wasn't necessarily what people were kind of growing up with in their home places. So that's when I realized it was maybe a different version of upbringing than a lot of people have.
Yeah. And when in the process, when did you discover you were going to make stuff as a kid?
You know, I always used to make stuff. Like, I remember I was in really, really young. I think we had, like, in second or third grade, our teachers were running this, like, printing press in our class where you would, like, draw a picture and you would, like, write out a sentence or something and be, like, that was, like, and make a few of them and that was, like, your book. And everybody, like, spent a long time making one book and I have, like, 15. Like, I was, like, out here just
shitting
trying
on
to,
these
like,
kids.
Yeah, like, I was, like, look at my books. And then eventually they were, like, you need to stop making books and I had to go somewhere else. But there's kind of a way that I've always been drawn to things like that. And also, like, we in fifth and sixth grade, me and my friends, we used to have this thing called book sharing where we would have to like read a book and like talk about it. And we would write these like elaborate plays about all the books that we read. And there was this one moment where we had like drafted like a, I don't know, it was like a 15-act book report play on this one book that we read. And our teacher was like, how long is this? And we were like, we still have like 6 more acts. And she was like, okay, we're going to continue after recess. Like, literally, like, that was, like, what I did, was just, like, loved these projects and loved doing things like that. And my uncle, one of my uncles is an architect, and we used to play with his models a lot. And we used to make model-to-scale models, like, with him, you know? And it was really fun because we got to use, like, hot glue guns and we got to, like, you know, do these things. But there was a way that, you know, I had a really creative, like, I just really was drawn to things that were creative growing up.
And what do you remember a book that like really kind of captured your imagination early on? I mean,
I remember reading Harry Potter and being like blown by that, you know, and And I just, like, was so, so excited to be reading about this world. And I really thought I was going to get my letter. Like, I was, like, convinced I was going to go to Hogwarts. but then how I started writing was, you know, I started writing Harry Potter fan fiction. That was, like, my way into writing was being, like, cool. Like, I'm going to find these really weird, seedy online communities.
I was going to ask you if it was online.
Yeah, where we were all writing Harry Potter fan fiction. And it was really fun. You know, it was really, really fun. And it was.
What I don't, because that's the whole world. I'm, you know, too old to even know what that is. But like, fan fiction is like you imagine a different reality for the character.
Yeah,
or something like
so
that.
Basically, like you take up characters or you make up characters that exist in the world that are like not in the books, and then you like play from their point of view. And there's like other people who write, and so you're kind of writing like a scene together, like in, you know, and so you'll write something, someone else will write something, and then you'll write something.
Oh, but all in an online community. Mm-hmm. So you also had friends.
Yeah, those are my friends. No, I had friends, but also I didn't tell, like, in my high school friends, I, like, didn't tell them that I was doing this. I would, like, go home and do it. And my sister, we would joke about this because my sister kept a live journal.
Oh, I had a live journal.
Yeah, and hers was, like, password protected, but I found it, and I, like, read all of this. It was basically, like, her journal, right? And I remember going up and talking to her after and being like, so do you feel like you're the pillar that holds the family together? And she would get so mad at me because it was like direct lines from her stuff. And then she told me a few years ago, she was like, yeah, I saw your Harry Potter like sites that you would be on. But apparently she was a better sister than I was.
She didn't
read
go
them.
Quote
yeah,
you
she didn't. Yourself. She was just like, I don't know what that is. I'm not going to look at it. This is weird. But yeah, we shared a computer and that's what we would do.
Yeah. I mean, I think I missed the whole fan fiction thing, but, like, I feel like all the people in high school who did fan fiction were incredibly odd.
Like, yeah. That's why I didn't wasn't tell anybody, though, them, you know, because right. I have, like, an image to maintain.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. You got to keep that weirdness at bay.
Yeah, yeah. I was very embarrassed by it.
When did you start telling people you wrote, though?
That I wrote fan fiction?
No. Or anything, I guess.
You know, I didn't really start talking about writing until I was in college. And I would go to, that's where I met Jamila. So me and my best friend Jamila Woods, we met the first day of school. We were in the lunch line at our pre-orientation program.
Brown University, Providence, Rhode Island.
Yes. Okay. And Jam, you know, was like, I'm really into spoken word. Like, do you want to come to the? I hear there's a group here. Do you want to come? And I had seen spoken word before, but there was no like community in my. Nobody I knew wrote poetry or performed it. So I was like, yeah, totally. And I went, and I remember just being really in awe of people. And I would just kind of go and like sit and listen. And it took me like a little while before I like wrote and was sharing with people. But then that kind of became my community. So that was really when I first started to share that I was writing. But even then, like, I didn't really tell my high school friends I was doing that, and I didn't really tell my family. So I kind of kept that world compartmentalized from my other world, and I did that a lot. I would keep my worlds compartmentalized because it felt like I couldn't have them all together. But then, you know, by the time I was a senior, I realized that, like, the thing that really made me happy was writing, and when I wasn't writing, I was deeply miserable. And so I, you know, was like, I don't really want to, I went to school for international relations and Africana studies, and I thought maybe I would be going into, like, a more international-focused job, and I was like, no, this actually makes me deeply unhappy, and what I want to be doing is writing. And so there was kind of a way that I felt like it got to the point where I could no longer keep that as, like, a hobby or a side hustle, and it became the thing that I wanted to do.
So your family is Pakistani?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I mean, I'm Indian, so, you know, I don't. Growing up, I never really met a lot of brown people who didn't do, like, take the prescribed path of whatever, doctor, engineer. But did you, like, compartmentalize because you were afraid of how your family would react, or?
You know, no, I mean, I think so. I also, you know, I'm an orphan, and I didn't have the immediate. It's really different when you don't have, like, parents breathing down your neck asking you what you're doing, right? And that doesn't mean that I don't have aunties and uncles who do that, and, you know, people who are even not my blood family but who raised me who do that. But also, I, you know, where I grew up, all of my South Asian friends were of, like, lower class backgrounds. And so there wasn't really often the same kind of conversation around, doctor, engineer, whatever, because a lot of it was like folks who were lower class and just immigrated. And it was really about like just kind of, and that doesn't mean that they weren't strict and they didn't have things that they would pressure us into, but it was really, really, really different. And I think there became a point really early on where I just wouldn't tell my family anything and I would just do stuff, right? So like I would just be like, because also we didn't have adult supervision. Me and my sisters were growing up by ourselves, so there was really nobody who was checking up on us every day being like, where are you at? What are you doing? And so I could be out and do whatever I wanted. And I, you know, I applied to school and I didn't tell my family I applied to school until I got in. Like, I was like, oh, I got in. It's fully funded. You don't have to worry about anything. I'm going. Right. And then they were like, oh, cool. Great. Like, awesome. This is great. And I was also the youngest. And so my sisters kind of bore a lot more of that brunt of being like the kind of like first generation of kids in America and trying to figure out some of that stuff. But, you know, my family kind of has always treated me like I'm the weird one that they don't really know what to do with. And so there's a way that has also offered me a lot of freedom. Like whenever I visit my aunt and uncle at home, they joke, but they say this thing where they were like, we thought you were going to be nothing but mediocre your whole life. Right. And like, it's, you know, they joke about that, which is true. And so there's kind of a way that I think all of that stuff really gave me a lot of freedom.
I mean, that doesn't sound like very nice, though.
What?
The mediocre part.
No, I know. But also, my family's full of assholes. Like, they literally have made fun of me my whole life. And yeah, it's just like, that's just who they are, you know?
Do you feel like you're the weird one?
Out of my family?
Yeah.
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 And do you feel, I mean, and then once you met Jamila and then that creative community that mm-hmm. you began to find at Brown, did you feel like you were with like-minded weird ones or other weird ones? Or
yeah, I mean, I think we're all weird, right? And there's a, yeah, and I think that we like hyper-analyze everything and we're all really, really weird. But what I love is that we're all very different. You know, like I think when you look at all of our identities and even like our class backgrounds or the way we grew up, like we all grew up really, really differently, but we all had really shared interests. And what, you know, what I loved is like, people had like a lot of awareness, and I think it's because we came into this pre-orientation program where we talked about like isms at Brown, so people would talk about classism and racism, whatever. But there was a way that folks didn't really want, like I've heard about at other schools where like kids are just super rich and they make everyone who's not rich feel uncomfortable, right? And like that wasn't my experience at Brown, but I think that's because my friends were hyper aware of things, you know? And so even if folks had relative privilege in whatever that field was, right? Like if it's race or religion or whatever, there was a conscious way that people were interacting with each other, trying to like not do that to each other, right? Trying to build conscious solidarity and not the other way. And so that was something, but I think we were all really weird. And I think like our house, like my sister would come and visit us and just be like, y'all are nasty. Like nobody cleans. Like this is so gross. Like I remember we had a party and there was like jean stains on our wall because people were dancing up against the wall and it was so sweaty.
Right. And sign of a good party though.
Yeah, yeah. But my sister was like, how do you not clean? Like you live here, right? Like how do you not
maybe
clean
could
that
get cleaned up
the
yeah,
next
yeah,
day?
A little bit, yeah.
So there was a way that, you know, I think my sister and my sister's friends thought of me and my friends as like the little weird kids that were like at this school just living together doing weird stuff, and we were like, that's probably true, but yeah.
So I want to talk a little about relationships because I feel like they're very important to you.
Mm-hmm.
I also have a question, Tara. You know, and you know, Mike, I'm talking to you now, and we'll hopefully edit this, but should Runzi stay in there, or should we invite her in here to join, not join the conversation, but just to be in this room, or?
I don't know. Can he hear? Is he in
I
there?
Don't think so. I don't, Mike can't hear, no.
How long have we been recording for?
It's been about, you know, 20 minutes, I think.
Okay. I mean, I feel like they're separate conversations.
Oh, no, they're definitely
right.
Separate
oh,
conversations,
just
but just sit in the room as opposed to sitting there. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
So she doesn't sit alone. For
is that okay?
Minutes. Yeah.
For like, yeah, 15,
I mean,
20.
Another 20, 25 minutes at most, right?
Yeah, at most. Are you doing okay, Fatih?
Oh, yeah. I just want to move my bag so she can sit there.
Okay. Yeah. But yeah, she'll, and then we'll just get her in next. This is great, though.
Yeah. I'm having fun. Do you guys want some of these wrap snacks?
They're, you know, I have some here. They're really good, though. Runzi!
Hey.
How are you?
Hello.
Good. You guys know each other?
No.
Oh, Fatih runs.
Really? Y'all did the video together?
Yeah, they shot on different days.
That's crazy. Yeah, that's the magic of filmmaking.
All right. Yeah. You don't have to do it all at once.
Good. Thanks for doing this. Mike, we doing okay?
Great.
Okay. We're going to pretend like you're not here right now, though, but as opposed to you sitting in there, we have probably like another 20 minutes with Fatih. Is that okay?
I mean,
you
could,
yeah. And then.
I could have sat out there. That was cool. I didn't want to, like, No.
I didn't know. Is this, okay. All right. Sorry to interrupt. yeah, Rue. Do you want to stay in there, or what do you prefer?
I don't really care. I mean, I probably would prefer to stay over there just so I won't be, like, texting
him. Okay. All right, that's cool. Yeah, and then
okay.
Yeah, so we got another like 20 minutes.
Yeah. I was trying to communicate with you.
I know, and then I got self-conscious, and I was like, I don't know, what should we do? I don't want to be rude. But all right, but you're good to hang out for a few.
Yeah, I'll chill there.
Okay, thank you. All right.
Okay, cool. So we'll just pick up from.
Yeah, you too.
Okay, and then all this shit is still on, but I noted. I'm like, Mike, this shit is not in it.
Okay.
All right, and then we'll go back to like Mike. Now we're back again.
Yeah, that's all right. Perfect. And then just when you guys finish up.
Bet.
Cool.
Thank you, man.
Thank you. Wait, what were we even saying, though?
No, I remember. I remember exactly where we were. You guys ready to go again?
Yes.
All right, Mike, we're back in it. So I want to talk about these relationships because I feel like they're very important to you and even your development as a person and as an artist. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you mentioned your relationship with Jamila.
Mm-hmm.
And so you guys met at college and you guys have in a lot of ways risen together in a creative community, and if you could, what does that relationship mean to you, and how do you guys interact as people but also as artists? What is that back and forth like?
Yeah, I mean, I think relationships are everything to me. Like, I don't, you know how like some folks are like, if no one else was in the world, I would still be writing. Like, I think I probably would be, but I don't know if it would mean the same thing, right? Like, I think poems are important to me because they exist in a conversation, right? And they help grow people. And like with Jam, like, our friendship to me is so important, and it's something that like is such a strong bond that has allowed me to, as you said, like become the person I am and like explore parts of myself that maybe I wouldn't have otherwise and things like that. And you know, I was like I heard someone say this thing where they were like talking about identity and being like, you have to be able to be in a safe space in order to fully explore aspects of your identity. Like, if you're not actually in a safe space, then like you don't have the freedom to try things. You don't have the freedom to kind of be there. And so what you do is you shut yourself off and you think along societal lines, right? You think about like, this is this way and this is whatever. And I think when I think about my friendship with Jamila, I think what it is it offers me that safe space to be who I am fully and authentically and to not have to worry about anything else. Like, so to not have to worry about like labels or what might seem contradictory or what might seem correct or incorrect, but just to be a person that's like able to explore myself fully and explore who I am and who we are together. And so, and that to me is like so important in art making, right? If you're just kind of like sitting there, a lot to me about even I write about identity a lot, but to me, those things are explorations. Like, I think Terrence Hayes has kind of this quote about that in one of his poems where he's talking about like this. He says something like, this is one of the many ways that I'm still figuring out what it means to be Black. Right. And I think that's such a beautiful sentiment, that thing that you can be something your whole life and not know what it means and be figuring out that facet, those facets for so long. And so what's great is to have like a partner or a series of partners or relationships that allow you to do that, that allow you to like be comfortable and safe enough where you're able to explore and question and pull and pull and just understand who you are and how you relate to the world better.
Yes. I feel like that kind of friendship or relationship is kind of, is rare.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't think I feel that way about anyone.
Hmm.
What?
No, not
what?
You.
Come
Kevin.
On, man. All right, look, I was just trying. It was just, you
you're
know.
The one who's, you're missing an action forever. So. All right,
that's fair. That's fair.
Yeah, right. And I mean, but part of that is, because I try to think about like what led me and Jamila to be friends. And like, sometimes I think it was just like a decision. Somehow we just made a decision that we were in it. Like,
right.
We were, you know.
Committed.
Yeah, like I would. We lived in the same building, but I lived down the hall and around the corner from her. And every day I would go to her door in the morning and I'd be like, let's go to breakfast. You know, like, let's do this. And that's, you know, that's how, to me, like, so much of relationships is built around intentional time spent together and being like, we are being intentional about hanging out or kicking it. Maybe we're just like going to bars and hanging out and talking shit, but that's like a kind of way to build that friendship, right? And yeah, I just think friendships are so important to me, and I really thrive in community and when I feel held by community. And I feel really lucky in that I have a lot of relationships like that with many different people, and they all kind of come in different ways. And, you know, and I'm really grateful for that, like, kind of intentional love building that I feel like exists in my life.
Well, and, yeah. that relationship is also kind of the, you know, the kernel that creates the Emmy nominated web series Brown Girls.
Yeah.
And so in some ways it also introduces, because it also brings you to Sam Bailey.
Yeah.
Your co-creator.
Yeah, of, who I also love.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And so, I love that, you know, web. I mean, obviously the world loves that web series. And it is about, you know, these, you know, that those kinds of intentional, like, ride or die relationships amongst women, which is really powerful, women of color, to see, to see that represented on, you know, screen of any size. And how is your relationship with Sam then also influenced your, you know, who's an incredible director and creator and writer and person in the world too? How is that relationship in a new genre also affected and influenced how you create and think of yourself?
Yeah, I mean, so Sam and I were friends. We were loose friends before Brown Girls, right? And we would like hang out, and we would do things where, like, you know, I did a photo series around people of color, and I photographed Sam, right? And Sam would do reading series in Chicago, and she would invite me to read, right? So there was a way that we were always on each other's radar in terms of these other ways, but we had never collaborated together. And Sam and I really became friends through Brown Girls. And it was like, you know, that it's like, again, that intentional time, but like, it's also like when you're making something, when you're birthing a web series, which is so difficult, like it is... I was just tweeting about this earlier today, but it takes a village to raise a TV show. Like, it is so many people who are doing things, who are running around, who are helping you out, who are doing all of this stuff. And it's kind of amazing when you think about the magnitude of everybody who has worked in some way on Brown Girls, right? And, like, a lot of folks are not always credited because it's, like, people have read early scripts or they've connected me to people or whatever. And
an estimate of how many hands, eyes on the project, you think?
I don't even know. Like, I don't know. You know, I can't even begin to say that.
Hundreds, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, at this point, like, as you know, when you think about it, I think when you think about articles, like, how many people have written articles about Brown Girls? At least 50, right? Yeah. Like, and so there's kind of a way that, I don't know. I don't know anything about numbers. That feels right to me, but maybe that's an exaggeration. But, like, there is a way that it's, like, all of those people in some way played into the success and the part of Brown Girls. And so... it's such a big process. But Sam, you know, Sam was my ride or die through all of it. It's like when we didn't get the funding when we needed, when something would happen and it felt like maybe it wasn't going to happen or maybe this thing was missing or whatever. Like, me and Sam have spent hours and hours and days and on the phone together. You know, if we were to calculate the amount of times that we've spent working on this project, I cannot even tell you, right? And like, we, you know, we text each other, like, every day. We call each other a lot. And it's kind of this thing in which it's also really important because at a certain point, you just start to realize, like, this person has my back. Like, even if we get into a disagreement about something or whatever, like, this person has my back regardless, and I have their back. And it's really important when you're entering an industry like Hollywood, right? I think that, like, part of the beauty about, and I know that there's like pettiness in the poetry community, but part of what I think about the beauty of the poetry community is that people want to love you, right? Like, there's like a real like want to hold and love and to respect each other's work. And then you go into Hollywood and the stakes are really different and people are, and especially for like women of color, you know, it's kind of a lonely place. And so I think that having each other navigating that field has been instrumental to me. Like, I don't think I could survive. Like, I don't think I would be where I am. There's no way I would be where I am without Sam Bailey. And there's also, like, just a way that I think about knowing that we have each other's backs and we're in this industry makes me feel like we can be unstoppable in some ways, you know, or, like, we can make the careers we want. Because we know we can trust each other. If you know you have one person in your corner, like, that's, you've already won the world a little bit, and you can kind of keep building from there.
Did you guys know you were gonna, like, Bum Rush Hollywood? Was that an intention when you started, you know, with this? I mean, because the web series at that time was, obviously there were precedents, but, you know, you guys had a quick elevation into into that world. Was that an intention from jump or no?
No, I mean, also, like, I thought, like, when I was thinking about Brown Girls, like, I don't know. I feel like we talked, you know, Kevin, you helped me a lot with Brown Girls, and you were part of the reading. You came to the reading when we did it for the first time, and there was kind of a
way
that...
I might just start to add Emmy nominated to my shit. You know what I mean? Just like... You know, adjacent, Emmy nominated adjacent, maybe. I could put it in my bio. I could put it in my bio.
But I want to know, like, how you, was there, like, something that, was there a reason you wanted to tell this story?
Yeah, I mean, part of it goes back to, you know how, like, you would see when people are watching something with their friends and they're like, oh, look, it's me and you. Like, Jam and I rarely had that. There was rarely moments where we could be like, it's me and you. And we would have it around certain things, you know, but a lot of times they were memes or they were things on web series. They weren't like, they were things on digital platforms and they were not things in mainstream media. And so, or it would be like white versions that we were like, oh, their personalities are kind of like us, you know? And there was a way that I really wanted to create something that was something that me and her could be like, it's me and you, like, you
literally.
Know, or like, it's us, you know, it's our friends. And really, when I created it, I had no idea. Like, I thought my friends would watch it, right? Like, I thought I was making something that my friends would be sitting in a room and watching it. And I was like, it would be successful if folks in Chicago who I didn't know watched it, right? Like, that's what I thought, to me, was like the pinnacle of what the web series would do. It was my first time screenwriting. I had no idea anything about, like, film festivals or anything. Like, that wasn't on my radar. And I remember after the reading we did, there was a producer who was a woman of color who wanted to talk to me after. And I was like, cool, yeah. And she was like, you got to add white people to this. Like, I've worked on series for HBO. I've worked on things with other networks. And no network will pick this up if there is no white people in the series. And I was like, cool, I don't care. Like, you know, it was this thing where I was like, this is not the vision. And
are there no white people?
There's no white people in the series.
Wow. I don't think there's really white extras.
There's no white people in front of the camera.
Is that, like, reflective of real life? Or,
I mean,
or that was a choice you made?
That was an intentional choice you made. Okay. And I think that, you know, I think that my communities have often been people of color with like sprinkles of white people,
right?
But they have been predominantly led by people of color. And I think what we wanted to do was we wanted to take it in that totally opposite direction and be like, you know what? Like, how many times do you see movies where there's only white people, right? Mm-hmm. Or there's like, that's like the norm. And then so how can we really, really, really go against that? And that's what we did, was we were like, that we want this to be a celebration of people of color. And also there were white people who worked on the project and they all got it. You know, they were like, absolutely. And then when, if they, you know, in our party scene, like when the camera would pan, all the white people would duck behind the bushes, you know, who were like on set, like working set. And it was because they knew, they understood why. And I think that's what happens, is the lack of diversity in things like Hollywood or whatever. It doesn't just hurt people of color. It hurts white people, right? Like when you do not see how many people of color exist in America, when you do not see people like that in TV, in mainstream media, in depicted in positive ways, that hurts everybody. That hurts all America in totality, right? It's the same way that, like, patriarchy hurts men, right? And, like, that's not to say they're the primary victims, but they are victims of that. And I think that as a creator, that was really interesting to me to see a lot of folks who maybe I didn't intentionally make this for, but who were like, I love this show and I'm really grateful you did that. And I was like, cool. Like that kind of gives me faith in people that, like, people would be able to not center themselves in something, but see the importance of it.
Yeah. And that's part of the purpose of art. And I think that's also one of the reasons why it's so successful, is that it seems authentic. You know, I mean, the language, the interactions between, you know, many of the characters in there, it's shit that you just see in your life. And so regardless of who's in it, I think it does that work of universality through, you know, the craft of the story that you're telling, you know.
The one scene that always sticks out in my mind is where it's supposed to be Jamila, or the character, like, I don't remember her name.
Patricia.
Yeah, she has the guy in her room, and somebody's calling an Uber. She's calling him an Uber because he won't leave or something.
Yeah.
but I was like, I'll never call nobody an Uber. Like, unless I really need them to get out.
Important. I mean, yeah, I strive to one day be able to do that. But also what's important is like these characters, you know, what I wanted to do was convey the intimacy of mine and Jamila's friendship and the way they're ride or die. But these characters are not actually like
me. Right. You know, but the one that's supposed
totally.
To be. Right.
But I think because, you know, we had our students on set one day and we were filming something and they were like, oh, my God, did Jamila really get fired? And did you do this? And did you punch someone? And I was like, you guys,
it's
fiction, relax. You know, like relax.
Y'all are so smart and so dumb.
Yeah, why? Like I love you so much, but this is not what, you know, like when you're talking about artistry, you have a kind of, unless you are writing journalism or nonfiction, that's like you have freedom to kind of invent and to talk and whatever. And it's sometimes it's like dangerous to think those things are so one-to-one, even in poetry, you know, when you're talking about that, because like what is an image but a kind of like fictionalization of something, right? Like what is a metaphor but that, and or a kind of radical truth, right? And I think that the truth kind of exists somewhere in between those two things, but I don't think that you can necessarily take one piece of art and then assume that that's someone's whole life. Yeah. Right.
Where is Brown Girls now in terms of where you're at in writing the new season for HBO? Where is that process? And I kind of want to talk about your pilot too, and ultimately the book as well.
Yeah.
But where can people expect to see the next, you know, iterations of those narratives?
Yeah, well, inshallah, it will be on HBO. Like, yeah. So the thing about development, which I didn't realize any of this stuff before I started working in TV, and I think it's a kind of fascinating world. But development is when a network picks it up and they start to develop it with you. So you're working closely with execs and you're working with your producers to develop the show and to develop the story. And especially when you go from a web series, which to me is a lot like a poem, like a web series, because it's a lot about moments. It's moments that these characters are in. It's scenarios. It's whatever. And then you kind of lengthen it out. When you go to a more traditional format of TV, there's a lot of folks' voices who are involved. And but development can take a lot, anywhere from like 6 months to years, right? So when you're thinking about like Issa's show was in development for 3 years at HBO.
Oh, wow.
You know, it was in development for a minute.
It's like a label deal?
Yeah, I mean, it's long.
The thing about label deals, you know, like a lot of artists complain is that there are too many. Like, the people at the label's voices affect the outcome of the art, you know?
Yeah, I think that they do. But I think that what is helpful is you have to think about execs like editors, right? And if you have a good editor, it's going to affect it for the better, right?
Right.
Like
guess what I'm thinking is negatively.
Yeah, and the thing I think about with like even thinking about like my book, right? Like it is a better book because I have an amazing editor, Nicole Counts, who is on it, right? Like this book, it has gotten so much better because I had folks like Kevin who looked at it and who helped edit it with me, right? It would not be that way if I was on my own floundering with my poems, like, you know, and a lot of times TV shows can be that way. Like I really like the notes that we get, right? And I think that there's a way that the show is being pushed to be a better show, as being a better version of what it could be, and it's allowing me the freedom to do a lot more stuff, right? But also like when a show is in development, they have the right or the ability to say yes or no when you're done with the pilot to if they're going to shoot it or not. So you can be in development and then they can say no.
Wow.
And you can also have written and shot the whole thing and then have them say no. Like you can have
at
a whole series.
Yeah.
They can say no at any point.
Yeah.
And that's, they can shelf it.
But they back, like financially they back it, mm-hmm. the pilot.
Yeah. They back the writing of the pilot. And then if they say yes, they back the
shooting,
the shooting and all of that. So that's kind of it's a really strange spot sometimes for a creator because you're creating something that isn't guaranteed.
Right.
But you're putting your whole body and soul into it.
And you don't own it, right?
Yeah, you know HBO or you're working with HBO,
right,
and they own the rights,
own it.
Right?
So
but also your rights can revert back to you. So there's
okay.
a way, you know, it's, I think, I hope that's like music too. I don't know enough about
music.
I don't
think I know.
But that's kind of dependent on everybody's deal is different. And so that's the way that stuff works.
And hopefully artists are getting savvier too about the retention.
Oh, that's
of
the whole thing about
and
masters, right? And Jay-Z trying to buy his masters and all
yeah,
that.
You wanna, yeah, you
yeah.
want to own, you
right.
want to own your IP,
yeah.
your intellectual property.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. And but part, you know, part of it is like, ideally you have a great relationship with your network and you're able to do that. And I like, you know, I really love working with HBO, and I think that's something about HBO is they really believe in a creator's voice, and that's what they're drawn to, and so they're not trying to supersede your voice, you know, and that's really cool. So I have really positive experiences, right? Yeah. It's also very different than like a web series. Like I wrote Brown Girls in like a few very short time. It was the fall of 2015, and then we had shot by August 2016. We released by February 2017, right? Like that's fast. And I think that when you're talking about TV stuff, that's a lot longer.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. So so you're writing a pilot simultaneously for them or for you? Because you're at work at this other venture, which is it's the pilot for Brown Girls, or it's the pilot, it's like some other shit.
It's some other stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
Can you even talk about it or not?
No,
really?
I can't.
Can't even talk about it.
Are you working on like another show?
Look, she can't even talk about it. Oh. Like, I don't know why. Now, Tara, you're just like,
okay, I have no information until you.
But that's part of being a creator at anything is like you're working on a lot of things simultaneously, right? And part of it is sometimes it might not go anywhere, but it's exercise. Like, how many poems do we write that then we trash, right? Like, so many, or that you think are really good, and maybe you perform sometimes that's what then they don't ever get published, or they don't get put into a book. And so there's kind of a way that even with writing, you have to practice that muscle. You have to practice screen, like, even if you're, especially if you're in different genres, you got to build the craft. And so being able to kind of work on a lot of stuff is really fun, because you're like, cool, I get to do this. But I don't know if I'm a typical writer, but I would love to be in a writer's room, right? Because I would love to write someone else's voice. Yeah. You know, it would be really fun to be like, I'm writing a Western, or I'm writing this thing. And it gives you a kind of freedom when like you're able to see someone else's vision and help them achieve their vision. And that's, again, the thing about relationships is like, not everything has to be about you or your name or your vision. You can look at a lot of folks' artistic work and be like, I can do this here. I can help you here. I can do this. Like, I can edit for you. I can help fill this out. And all of that is artistically fulfilling in some ways.
Yeah. And I think just that sense of collaboration. I also dream about the writer's room.
Yeah.
You know, and just like who would be in there, just like making dope shit and not having to be. Yeah. That sense of camaraderie, community, collaboration, I think would be.
Right.
Would be really ill. But let's talk about your book of poems, because that is forthcoming.
Yes.
You have a pub date.
Yes, it's summer 2000, next year. It's 2000, what's the year? 2018.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Okay.
So I think it's in June. I think it's late June.
And even, the title is Not Today, We're American.
It's
right?
If They Come For Us, yeah.
Right, mm-hmm. So even that switch.
Yeah.
Talk about the significance of...
What's the whole title?
So the new title...
is If They Come For Us.
And the old title was Today, We're American.
Yeah.
And you shifted because... Mm-hmm.
So basically, I came up with the title Today, We're American, and it felt really right. It felt like it was like a really good kind of conversation around the book. The book deals with a lot of different themes. It deals with the themes of immigration, and specifically thinking about the violence of partition, which is when Britain left South Asia, and South Asia divided into India and Pakistan in a really violent conflict. And thinking about that, and then patterns of immigration my family took, and then to growing up here, and kind of like facing a few different waves of Islamophobia in my life, right? So that's like the bulk of the book. I had this title of Today We're American because to me the book was an immigration story, right? It was a story of many layers of immigration. And then my editor says something, who I ride for my press and my editor really hard. So my press is One World. It's an imprint off of Random House. Chris Jackson is the main editor. And then
I work with
Nicole Counts. And I love One World's vision. I love the way that they talk about writers of color, stories of color. And I love Nicole, right? Like, I think I really trust Nicole. And so I was able to listen to her and have this relationship where we really grew the book. And she was saying to me, she was like, when you say to like the title Today We're American, it's a really beautiful title. But what it does is it contains the story to a kind of Americanness, when really what you're talking about is a lot of patterns of like across many countries and, you know, around immigration. And it the book is not it is about Americanness, but it's also about partition. You know, it's about all of these things that are not American and don't really and that Americans actually maybe need to know about a little bit more. And so that made me think about how, you know, what would it look like to not have American in the title of the book, and what would it look like to have a different title? And then the title comes from a poem that is this, of the same title, If They Come For Us. And it really is about, to me, that feeling of, like, persecution across multiple generations of family, and thinking about what does it mean when folks come for you, and what does it mean when you come for folks, right? And I think that that's, like, a really – because it's too easy to just say that it's one way, right, if they come for you, and then not to have it be the other way. And partition was a legacy where you had neighbors killing neighbors, right? And so you nobody can say that they are solely the victims of partition, like, right. Or their religious group is solely the victims. And so there's kind of a way that If They Come For Us became – to me, the anthem poem of the collection, but then also the a thing that kind of fit into a lot of the different kind of conversations I was having around, you know, immigration and race and sexuality and all of that together.
The two titles are also the different eras of the presidency, though, aren't they? Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, like, Today We Are American was conceived in the Obama era.
Yeah.
And then it switched during the era of Fascist 45. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that's, yeah, I think that's, I mean, that's significant.
It is.
A really, yeah, I think, dope move.
Yeah.
I'm so excited for the book.
It's
beautiful. It's a beautiful book, and I'm so excited for it to be in the world.
Yeah, thanks. Sorry, I cut you off. But, like, thinking about that, that's really interesting. I always thought of Today We're American as a menacing title to me, even though maybe it doesn't come across that way, because what I thought of it as Today We're American and Tomorrow We're Not, right? Mm. Like, is like a transient thing, is like, this is the thing we are now, and then that can change really quickly. And so to me, that there's a lot of history in that title, and there's a lot of different ways. And I think it was because I was thinking about the book as an overall thing, and thinking about how quick, like, my parents' generation, right? Like, they were British under, you know, like, or like British colonized, and then they were Kashmiri, and then they were Pakistani, and then they were English, and then they were American, right? Like, they've been so many things. When they were born, Pakistan did not exist, and that is wild, you know, to have thought about, like, the ways that countries, and then countries become fixed in our mind. Like, Pakistan is a fixed entity, whereas when it was created, people didn't think Pakistan would last more than a few years. They were like, oh, this is a temporary solution, and then we'll be one thing again, right? And that, the way that, you know, that national identities take hold and then disappear and then take hold again and stuff, that was really what I was trying to kind of convey in that title.
Yeah, cool. I feel like, you know, I feel like I got a few questions to outro just to see what, if you could maybe put us on to stuff.
Yeah.
What, I guess, what are you listening to right now?
Well, I am not listening to anything new. What I'm listening to is a lot of FKA Twigs as I take baths. she has a lot of bath music, I feel like. So,
have you ever listened to eBay?
Yeah. I really like them. I saw them in concert once in Chicago.
And the homie The Mind is opening for them, right?
He's on tour with them right now. Left today.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. And what are you reading?
I'm reading Jesmyn Ward's new book. And I'm really early into it, but it's really, really good.
Yeah, shout out Jesmyn Ward. Yeah. We love her. And what are you watching?
Oh, my God. I just finished rewatching the first season of Veronica Mars.
I love that show.
I love Veronica Mars.
Where is it? It's not online anywhere, I thought.
No, I bought it on Amazon. I was like, I want to.
No, I love that show.
But I really love, you know, and I have a lot on my docket. Like, I really want to see Westworld.
Westworld is hard body.
I heard it's really good.
It's tough, and it's good.
I'm really excited for the second season of Stranger Things. I watch Riverdale.
Me too. Riverdale. I saw it.
It's really good.
It's really good.
Wait, did you start watching the second season?
I did.
It's really good.
Yeah.
It's really good. I mean, I love the CW. Like, I know that.
A CW show?
Yeah, The Flash and Riverdale. Like, I love those shows.
It's such a nuanced, weird style.
Supernatural.
Yeah. And Veronica Mars used to be on the CW.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. CW has been making hits for many years.
No, they have. I mean, Gilmore Girls is on CW.
Yeah, you know? CW is a great channel.
I mean, they're really annoying now, and also the when they did the comeback on.
Oh, I didn't watch the comeback. Yeah.
Oh my god, it was so racist.
Oh really?
Like, I think not overtly racist, but like, you know.
Yeah.
It's like when white people are writing the script and say white people. Stuff.
Yeah, that's unfortunate.
Yeah,
wasn't One Tree Hill also on the CW?
Yes.
Oh yeah,
banger. Love yeah, right. When it was on Netflix, I watched so much of One Tree Hill.
I'm worried because they're redoing Dynasty, and I used to watch Dynasty with my moms in the 80s because I'm
Dynasty?
Grown.
It's a soap opera.
It's a soap opera. Yeah, like yeah, it was wild in the 80s, and that's what I remember. The 80s to me was like Prince. Breakdancing, my mom's Dynasty, and cocaine.
Wait,
and
that's what you know. You have to watch.
I'm gonna have to. I'm gonna have to see what it is. Yeah, I'm gonna have to see what it is.
Just to see.
I know. We'll see. Yeah, we'll see. No. So
it's on the CW website.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Wow, you really.
Oh yeah.
I'm writing for CW.
CW. Yo, you should maybe like write for CW too. That'd be fun.
I love the CW.
Yeah. That writer's room.
Anything else that you want to put people onto? Anything else that you're excited about? Anything that you're eating?
You know, I also read Marcus Wicker's book Silencer.
Yo.
That is a great book.
Yeah. Reading that, yeah.
Like, I love poetry that when you read, you, like, laugh out loud or you just cannot stop laughing and you have to share it with someone. Like, he has some lines where he's like, yo, I'm really good at schmoozing, but I fucking hate it. Like, I think that's, like, a lit line from his book. And I feel that way, and I'm actually not good at schmoozing, but I like, know that feeling. And I think that... I love that book. I love that writing, and that book is so good.
We've been using the prayer on Aladdin's lamp as a writing prompt, and I love the he's got like it's a riff off of Kendrick's Blue Faces.
Yeah.
And so I've been teaching that too.
Yeah.
There's a lot of like
And Kaveh Akbar's book is really beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Kaveh uses imagery in ways that are so different.
Wild. I just it's like a rabbit hole of twists and
you're just like in it.
Surrealism. Yeah.
Yeah. Really so beautiful. I love that. I have I just got Rachel McKibben's new book, and I have that on my docket. And Nicole Seeley's new book. So I feel like it was actually like this year launched so many books. Or this year, September, like there was like all these drops, like Eve's book and stuff. And so
Eve Dinez and Kaveh on the same day, right?
Yeah,
I think they dropped on the same day. Like,
all in their third printing, I think.
I know, on some like 50 versus yay type of drop.
And Sam Sachs,
Eve, but
they're all poets. And the thing that really, what I love about that is like this stupid conversation that comes up in every genre of like poetry is dead, like this thing is dead. And it's like you have these poets who are so relevant and important, whose work is amazing, and like they're all on their third printing of their books, and they all dropped like the same day or like within a week in September.
Yeah.
And that's incredible, right? Like it's incredible to be on your third printing of a book when you dropped in September and it's October. And so I just think it really inspires me, and it makes me really hopeful for like what poetry is and can do, and like the people who are writing poetry right now.
I mean, I just feel like if you're saying stuff like that, you're not paying attention.
Yeah.
And also, you should come to Chicago because it's not dead. I'm not the most knowledgeable about poetry, but it's not. I know it's not dead.
I know. And when people say that, though, I just think they don't have anything better to say. It's like stuff like, you know, that conversation comes up with like where people are like, this thing is dead.
Every
genre. You
didn't
say hip-hop is dead.
Yeah,
like,
I know.
What?
Yeah.
People say TV is dead.
Yeah.
People are dumb.
I know. And I'm just like, you guys... Everyone needs to calm down.
Yeah, right.
Everyone.
And come to Chicago for everything, basically. I think that's what you're part of. Hey. Fatih, we love you. Thank you so much
for
hanging with Tara and I in the corner store. And really appreciate you.
Thanks, y'all. Thanks for having me.
Shout out DJ Exist for the beat and Langston Austin for the artwork. The Corner Store is recorded at the WGN Radio Studios and produced by Mike Heideman. I'm Marlena, the co-producer, and I also run social media, so follow us at Shy Corner Store on Twitter and IG.